Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 28 of Pepperdine People. I'm Mark Cruz, and I'm joined today by Dr. Evan Adams. Dr. Evan Adams is of the Shlyamin First Nation in Powell River, British Columbia, Canada. We are honored that he is here today for a brief conversation on Pepperdine People. Dr. Adams, can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing in your hometown?
Sure. So I grew up in a small Indian reserve in Canada. And my parents were, they're both full bloods, but my mother grew up in a residential school, like in a school that was run by nuns. And my father grew up in the bush with his grandmother. So they were really quite different. My mother was one of the first Indian women in her area to graduate. My father didn't learn to speak English until he was a teenager. But they had, you know, they had a whole bunch of kids, including me.
Yeah.
And they really wanted me to be educated because they saw I had a kind of a flair for it. You know, I guess out of all my brothers and sisters, I was the one who could read really well. So they said, oh, he's the one who should go away to university.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done. So now I'm a physician. But somewhere along the way, I worked as an actor professionally for many years. And I think that's why I'm here. I think that's why people ask me to come and speak, because I'm from a particular indigenous way of life, and I've worked in the arts and the sciences.
Wonderful. I just want to ask you, what kind of memories do you have from growing up there?
Well, you know, when you're young, like any of us, we just know that way of life. We don't think it's abnormal or anything. It's just the way it is. And I grew up, I grew up in the bush on the land. My father quite regularly took me out of school because he knew that our way was an important way, and I needed to learn to do things like hunt and fish. And
maintaining the traditions.
Yeah. So he would bring me on the land, and he would bring me to the old people, because remember, his grandmother raised him, and that was his kind of his group. Not the city Indians, or the ones who didn't speak our language very well.
Yeah, the pan-Indianism.
Yeah, so that was really a very special way to grow up. I had no idea that not everyone grew up really close to the land. So a lot of my early memories are of waking up outside in the cold.
Yeah.
It's of, swimming in summer and winter. It's about food gathering and being with the old-timers, which meant listening, because they, they have lots to talk about. They had lots of experiences and stories and warnings and teachings, and it was a very special time.
That's great. And that's a great segue into my next questions. What are some of the lessons your elders taught you and that you take with you to this day? Because listening and being involved with elders is such an important, vital part of our American Indian tradition.
Yes.
So you'd speak to that.
Sure. There are a few things I remember very, very clearly. The first one was being really, really young and hearing the old people saying to me, who are you? Who's your mom and dad? Tell us who you are. What do you like to do? And they would say things like, you're not a bump on a log. You're not a dog. You're a human being, and that means that you speak and that we speak together. That's what we do as people. So they always told me to speak up for myself, and I still do that. I'm never shy. I see being shy as being like sitting on the couch and resting. So speaking up and telling people who you are and what you're thinking and what you've seen and what you know, or, like, for instance, I'd speak up for my patients or I speak up for my people. I was always told to be humble, to be a humble person, to shake everyone's hand, even if they're, small and poor or big and important. And I was always really told about, and I know this sounds corny, service, that we're supposed to help the people. We're supposed to go out and help others. That was just our way. And I think that's very sensible.
That's great. If you hadn't already known, service is in the Pepperdine mission statement.
Service, I didn't know
purpose,
that.
Leadership. So this is just, you're the ideal person to have here joining us.
Oh, that's
for this.
Great. And, I didn't understand service until, because, I did service as a teenager.
Right.
I helped out. I officially volunteered and unofficially volunteered. But after being an actor, where being an actor is very much like being walk and be pretty. Not stand and be pretty. It's walk and be pretty. It can be very superficial. It can be very much about how you look and who you know and how much money do you have and what designer are you wearing. And it wasn't until I started to do that and I would speak to people and they would say, oh, yeah, 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 but what designer are you wearing, that I really started to see, oh, that's what service is about. It's about not being superficial and silly, mm-hmm. you know, just really getting to the interactions that people are supposed to have.
Very good. We appreciate that. We're going to move on to more your acting, your acting lifestyle. And one of the roles you're most well known for is Thomas Builds a Fire out of Sherman Alexie's
Smoke Signals.
Smoke Signals and The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven off that book. And so I just want to ask you, in your role, Thomas Builds a Fire, in the movie Smoke Signals, can you describe what it was preparing for that role? What was that like? I know that in the movie, it's a bit different than in the book where he went silent. Whereas in the movie, he has a bit different character. Very chatty. So can you describe preparing for that?
Sure. When I was 18, I was actually a biochemistry student. And this woman came up to me on the street and she said, are you an actor? And I completely and utterly lied to her. And I don't know why. I don't normally do that to people. And I said, well, I guess any of us would say, yeah, I'm an actor. Why?
Wow.
And she said, can you come and read for me tomorrow? For this movie, and I started working after that as an actor professionally, and I really saw it as something that I wanted to be good at, so I should study it, mm-hmm. not just have an expectation of stardom, which I think a lot of young actors think of. You know, it was a skill I wanted, so I would do it, and I know that as an indigenous actor that we had a certain way of looking at acting and storytelling and character and story, so... So I spent, you know, a goodly number of years learning how to tell stories, the way that we tell stories around the fire and at home. So when Sherman Alexie's book came up to be shot, I thought, I know how to play this very traditional-like character who just tells stories about, you know, people he's known and places he's been. I knew how to do it. And so wanting a role is like being in love. You just have to screw your courage up and go for it and present the best of who you are and say, I'm really the best person for this. And so they gave me the role for whatever reason. and I really was just trying to capture a spirit of the people. Like I know this sounds strange, but I tried to be the most beautiful Indian, old Indian woman you've ever met. Because old Indian women who are very eccentric and very, you know, they're full of love and goodness. And they just treat you so well. And that's what I was trying to capture. Because I think that kind of traditional Indian woman is not as common anymore as mm-hmm. when I was a kid. When we were making the movie, I didn't think of us making a movie, like a Hollywood movie.
Right.
I didn't think anyone would ever see it. Wow. We were just a bunch of Indians making a film.
Right.
I wanted to capture a time and a place. I wanted to capture a certain character so that you know, people after me, Indians who came after me, could see what the old-time Indians were like. So that's what I was doing, and it took a lot of rehearsal. It was very hard work. It wasn't fun at all. And people asked me if it was fun to make a movie. No, it wasn't. It was really tough. And for the last 10 years or so, since it came out, I've been unable to watch it because playing Thomas is really different. How it felt is really different from how it looks. Because remember, I'm playing an old lady, but I'm a young man, or at least, you know, I was much younger then. So you see this kind of quirky young man, young male right. character, when in my heart I'm playing this wonderful elder. So the disconnect for me is hard to watch. Anyway, that's a long answer. My apologies.
No, that's great because, you know, a lot of the people know you for that role, and I think that was pivotal in your acting career. And it really led you on to other roles such as The Business of Fancy Dancing, which you won an award for. And I wanted to ask real briefly, because I know the character in that movie has such a split in his life. He's living in two different
yes.
dimensions, per se.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that, not necessarily in that role, but for American Indians in this country that have that split in their lives. Can you speak to that a
sure.
little bit? You know, balancing the traditional
yeah.
heritage versus this evolving urbanite attitude that, you know, America
sure.
really pushes.
Well, I'm glad you saw The Business of Fancy Dancing, because I don't think as many people saw it as they did Smoke Signals. Smoke Signals was bought by Miramax. It had really good distribution. It was quite a warm comedy drama
right.
once, that people responded to.
Once it won the 98 Sundance Award,
yes.
it really became a one-hit blockbuster,
yes.
per se.
You know, I felt like we won the lottery, because lots of independent films get made. But only a few of them get seen. And we got seen, mm-hmm. I dare say. And then after that, we did The Business of Fancy Dancing, which was a much darker, complex story of this Indian man who's left the reserve. He's in the city. He's gay. He's two-spirited. Doesn't get along with his family at home, and this dark interaction. And one of his friends has passed away. So it wasn't Smoke Signals. And I think audiences said, oh, what is this dark piece? But I think particularly for those of us who live in the cities or, you know, who are trying, you know, for bigger careers and being in the big wide world, I think it resonated for them somehow. Because mm-hmm. people at home say, what are you doing out there? What is that about? And who do you think you are when you come home? Do you think you're better than us just because you've seen the world and earned degrees and make money and that kind of thing? So hopefully, and if people haven't seen it, I hope they'll give it a watch. And again, that's another film that mm-hmm. I'm only just barely able to watch now, so many years later. It is hard. I hope most people are like me in that if they see themselves on film, they're not going, oh my gosh, look at me, I'm so amazing. right. Instead, I look at myself and go, oh, yeah.
Very critical.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to witness cinematic brilliance, you know, more than once. So I just want to move this conversation on to your more current endeavors.
Yes.
You serve as the director for the Aboriginal peoples in British Columbia, at the University of British Columbia.
Yes.
And you're a physician. And so I just wanted to ask, what was that trigger from leaving a career of acting where you could have lived your life doing that, you know, playing these American Indian roles, and going, you know, foregoing that onto a career of being a physician and helping these people?
Well, I guess after about 12 years of being a professional actor, so I was, you know, close to 30, one of my older friends really got panned by the critics. She was playing King Lear. She played a female King Lear. Mm-hmm. And she was brilliant at it. But the critics really savaged her. And I thought, oh, that's what I have to look forward to in about 50 years. someone will say, oh, Evan Adams, you suck. You're too old for this. You got to go. And I thought, well, as a physician, which I'd always thought about, as a physician, at least, you know, at least I would have some reward, like some monetary reward, that someone would say, you know, Dr. Adams, you made a lifetime of service. You helped thousands of patients. Congratulations. And all of my sisters, they work in economic development. One's a social worker. One's a teacher. One works in health. So they all work in service. They all help other Indians. And I thought, you know, what does an actor do? I had no illusions about what I was doing as an actor. And I thought, if I'm going to be a doctor, I have to do it now. I'm almost 30. I have to do this. So that's what I've done. I did my medical degree at the University of Calgary. I did my residency in family practice and a master's in public health. And that's where I work. I'm a physician in public health. And I oversee Indigenous people's health in my province of British Columbia. It's a really great job. I really love it. So I don't see patients. I watch over 200,000 Indigenous people around their public health issues, like public health or health knowledge, infections like mm-hmm. H1N1.
Swine flu.
That's I have the swine line here on my pocket, my cell phone. We've been working hard monitoring the health of Indigenous peoples in my province.
And is that one of the joys of your new job, is being a physician of that magnitude, serving your people?
Yeah, I think for any of us who, you know, who get professional training, once you have the degree, then you're looking for that dream job. You're looking for that job that you just love, a job that you can imagine spending a lot of your time at and a lot of your power. You know, the best of you mm-hmm. is spent doing that. I worked in a downtown east side clinic, like in an inner city clinic, working with people who were addicted to mostly to heroin. Mm. And that was really great, but it wasn't a perfect fit. So this is, for me, I think it's almost a perfect fit, if not a perfect fit. Overseeing large populations and looking after everything from oral health to infectious diseases, to hospitals and clinics, to village life and all of those social determinants of health. That's really a great place for me.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I just want to ask real quick, because we are in the university setting, what advice would you have to college students? You know, what advice do you have to them? And what are some tips that you wish you had known when you were in college?
Sure. Well, actually, I was told this really quite early. I was told that university is a really difficult place. And it is. And it's one, and it's lots of things. It's wonderful, too. You meet lots of great friends. I still have friends from many, many years ago that I made there. We went through boot camp together. And university gives you a chance to study lots of things, like human anatomy. I loved studying that and seeing patients who saw me as a student. And I, you know, as a student physician, you don't know anything. You know nearly as much as just, you know, the average person on the street.
Right.
So I appreciate that. But also it's a very painful place in that I think people feel very tired and stressed. I think they feel ashamed of their lack of knowledge, or they wish they were better, or smarter, faster. I think particularly for people of color, we have very few peers. So sometimes we're asked to be this voice in the wilderness. It can be very lonely
for
us.
A lack of community.
A lack of community. So I always want people to remember that they're a star. You know, we're stars in our communities. We're valuable. If we were at home in our home communities, those communities would honor us and say, you're really important members. You're young, you're strong, you're smart, you're able to help us. And we really think you're an important person. Whereas in school, you're not necessarily treated that way at all. You're just a foot soldier in an enormous institution, and you're having to work really hard for your dinner. So I always tell students when they're getting tired, when they're getting frustrated, when they want to quit, because we all get to that point, you're a star. You've got to keep going. You're the best person for this job, really. So I teach in the Faculty of Medicine. I have many students that I mentor, and I'm so proud of them because you see them go through difficult times and stuff that you wish you could take away from them, because they don't you know that many times their suffering is needless. Mm-hmm. They're going to get to the end point, which is having a degree. Mm-hmm. and getting really great work, and they'll be helpful. But in those moments where they're in the hot seat at school trying to make the grade, mm-hmm. boy, that's harsh. I wish there was a way I could make it easier for them, except by, well, I guess all I can do is encourage them and say, the end is in sight. You'll get through. You'll see.
Right. That's great. And I just want to ask one last question here relating to the American Indian cause was, what advice would you have to an Indian student in Canada or the United States going to university? Because we do see the challenges of preparing students in high school for the rigors of university. And even when we are successful in getting kids to the university, a lot of these kids struggle academically, being away from home, substance abuse, these types of deals. And so the percentages are pretty low of kids that ultimately make it to higher education, and then they drop out in 4 or 5 years. So what advice do you have to Indigenous students out across North America?
Well, I always remind them that we are entering into a different culture. Like, you know, we're from, you know, our culture of origin, I think, is very kindly and very permissive. And I think in order to accomplish in the school system, we have to take on another culture, which is a little more punitive and a little more spare. It's not as kindly. It doesn't give us such a gentle hand. In fact, it pushes us pretty hard. It's kind of smacks us around a bit, if I may say. So I just remind students of that you know, you're going to the dominant culture, but you don't have to kowtow to it. Like, your place of origin has tremendous value too, and you can always take the best of both. You really have a choice, because we have wonderful values from our homes. Things like I was talking about earlier, like humility and kindness, of service and of kinship, you know, connection to family. Attachment to the land, and no one gets left behind. You know, those kinds of lovely, lovely values that will give you excellence in life. Because that is the goal, right? Excellence in life, not excellence in school. Heck no. Not the point of the exercise is not excellence in school. It's excellence in life and excellence at, you know, the things that you choose to do. So I am the prize, the super objective.
Wonderful. And I want to thank you for taking the time this afternoon to come speak with us and Pepperdine people. I'm Mark Cruz, and like I said, I was joined today by Dr. Evan Adams from British Columbia, and it's just been a tremendous honor to have him here on Pepperdine's campus. And we look forward to welcoming you back in the future.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's been great to be here.
Thank you.